Welcome to Inside Investing. We're here with Nina Raghavan, contributor to the New York Times, particularly its Deal Book website, as well as Forbes. And we're talking about her book, The Billionaire's Apprentice, which is both the story of the rise of Indian American elite and the fall of the Galleon hedge fund. Now, Anita, I mean, you close the book with as tragic and heartbreaking as Gupta's fall from grace is, Gupta, of course, being a key player in this. It is a sign that Indians, much like the immigrant groups before them, have attained a certain security and once unimaginable position in American society. Can you expand on that?
Sure, Will. When I was growing up in the United States in the 70s, most of the Indians we knew were doctors, lawyers, and professors. What we see today is Indians in all walks of life. We have Indian filmmakers, Indian lawyers, Indian prosecutors, Indian authors, Indian businessmen. I recently was Googling and I saw that there's even an Indian visioner. Someone pays an Indian woman to provide her vision of the world. And, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, I mean, the whole idea that anybody would pay anyone from India to provide a perspective on the globe was just unimaginable.
Yeah.
So I really think that while this is a very sobering story and it's certainly heartbreaking for Gupta's family, it is really a sign that we as a community are no longer, you know, on the fringes of society. We're part of American society, we're part of the fabric, and we're standing up and we're being counted.
Yeah, and one of the stories you have in Gupta's rise is, I don't know if it was about him or about someone else, but a partner was saying, you guys are great consultants, but will our customers ever relate to you?
Right.
You know, and it doesn't seem like that's so much of a concern anymore.
Exactly. And, you know, yesterday I was speaking to a group and a young man who had been at Penn in the mid-80s came up to me and he said, you know, when I joined the University of Pennsylvania in 1986, somebody asked me, you know, where are you from? And I said, Indian. And the person responded, what tribe? You know,
yeah.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find that today.
Yeah, exactly.
Today, Indians have a cultural identity. There's even a sitcom, you know, based on the Indian offshoring model, and Indian food is enjoyed. And so it's a very different picture than what it was just 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And to harp on what it was, it's like this process of getting over here from India. I mean, this is not like, you know, this random group of Indians. This is the best and brightest of the entire country. Yeah, I mean, the process to apply for a visa, I mean, how competitive was that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, both Gupta and my own father came on an F-1 student visa. And in those days, the only way you could get an F-1 student visa is if you either found an American university to pay for your education, or you could pay for it yourself. And most Indians back then couldn't pay for it themselves, so they were completely reliant on U.S. institutions to fund their schooling in this country. And it was phenomenally difficult. And of course, today Indians are being brought to the U.S. not just for study, but to work. There's a whole new class of visa, the HB1 visa, which brings Indians over to do particular sorts of jobs, and that's a dramatic change from what it was.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, again, on the what it was thing, you know, we harp on history too much here, perhaps, but I just want to people listening at home, I mean, in 1650, this is a country that had GDP 80% the size of England's. That's 50 years after Queen Elizabeth died.
Right.
I mean, so it's not that, you know, India is a country that has only recently, you know, developed prosperity or developed, you know, some competitiveness in the world. It's been a power really for some time. I mean,
right. And I, of course, am from the south of India, and we'd always talk about our 5,000-year culture and the you know, rich temples and wealth that you know, was born far before America gained independence. And I think in a way, you know, the Indian diaspora in the United States has reclaimed that legacy with their success.
Do you think, I mean, so how integral is that legacy, you know, in the community itself? Is it something that people would talk about? Like, would they reference, you know, I'll belie my own ignorance by not being able to name a single, you know, prominent Indian leader, but from, you know, the ancient history, but would they, I mean, tell stories of these people, or is it not so much?
No, I don't think it was as obvious as that, but I think it was sort of an inner confidence that we had that we actually deserved a preeminent place in this world.
Sure, yeah.
And perhaps because of the struggles of the Indian economy after independence, we had been robbed of that place.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, and you see, I guess, elements of involvement with the country in the story of, sort of Galleon Group and Rajaratnam, him, of course, being Sri Lankan, but giving a speech at a benefit after a typhoon in Sri Lanka about, this impassioned speech about, how hedge fund managers and fishermen are just the same, and you see that deep level of involvement. Is that,
Sure. I think across the diaspora, both, with the Sri Lankan Rajaratnam, but also with the Indians, I think one of the big drivers behind Rajat Gupta, who's the central protagonist of my story, was this desire to help his countrymen back home. Mm-hmm. And some would even argue that may have precipitated his crime, because when he came to New York City, he got involved in philanthropy in a big way, and he started trying to raise money for Indian causes, and one in particular, the American India Foundation. When he first set that up, he crisscrossed the country, and all he could come up with was $50,000. And
wow.
I think he was just so taken aback that here was this wealthy diaspora, and all they could produce was, a pittance. Mm-hmm. And on some level, I think he was tired of collecting checks, and he wanted to be the one writing checks.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way to do that than to be a billionaire?
Well, yeah, that certainly is an easy way to be able
right.
to cut a big check.
Yeah.
One thing I want to touch on also is a cultural element that may not be too easy to appreciate, which is just the importance of skin color in India. And I spent time there. I was struck by the prevalence of skin lightening cream.
That's right.
It's a $500 million in annual sales industry.
That's right.
Rajaratnam, very dark skin.
Right.
Did that affect him in any way?
I think that's why when I approached the story, I always thought the friendship between Rajat Gupta, Anil Kumar, and Rajaratnam on the other side
yeah.
was sort of a forced marriage. it was not a natural friendship. The Indian community, as you say, is very much like the African-American community. There is a premium on light skin. And I think that on some level, Gupta and Kumar were only friends with Raj because of what he could offer, which, of course, was a clear path to money. And for Raj, I think there was a deep insecurity that came from his skin color. And I think it really drove him. In his early days, friends remember he would say, look at me, I'm a dark man and an ultimate outsider, but I've become the ultimate insider.
Yeah.
And I think he took great pride in that here he was, someone on the fringes of society who had actually managed to penetrate its inner sanctum.
Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. I mean, and so this place he's coming from, at one point there's a chapter called Offshorestan.
That's right.
In this, which, can neatly encapsulates the way a lot of people thought and perhaps still think about India.
Right.
There are a couple of great anecdotes. When McKinsey set up its office in Delhi, a partner had to install the switchboard because India didn't have anybody capable of doing that.
That's right.
That would seem to not be the case anymore.
Yes, I think India has come a long way from the early 90s when McKinsey set up its flagship office. And that's another way the diaspora was actually able to give back to India.
Mm-hmm.
Because Offshorestan, the growth of the outsourcing business, of legal services, business services, was a real driver of India's economic growth during the 90s and was promoted to a large extent by the Indians in the United States, who said, hey, you know, we know what country can provide some of the,
yeah, exactly.
the data skills that the U.S. needs. Mm-hmm. India, you know, mm-hmm. it has a large English-speaking workforce who are hungry to work for pennies on the dollar. And they basically created this new state, if you will.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, so they created this new state, and it sort of has grown into this thing where, I mean, we recently hired Cognizant Technologies mm-hmm. to do some IT work for
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know if that's the sort of thing you would have seen 20 years ago, but, you know, I guess it raises the question sort of what is India now? I mean, it's no longer Afghanistan. The rupee is down quite a bit.
Right.
Can it be Afghanistan again, or has it lost that essential cost advantage that it used to have?
I think it has lost the essential cost advantage on the plain vanilla offshoring business.
Okay.
But one of the great advantages of India and its people is that they are both highly numeric
mm-hmm.
and they speak English,
mm-hmm.
which is a rare quality that you get. You either get highly numeric or you get speak English. You don't get both in one package.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think what India now needs to do is redouble its efforts to go higher up the food chain
mm-hmm.
to get some of the more sophisticated outsourcing business that can flow from the Western economies.
Yeah, and indeed, perhaps, you know, produce its own stuff. I mean,
right.
I was hoping that we would see a Tata Nano cruising around the streets of New York City at some
point.
As yet, no. But
as yet, no.
But, you know, I mean, a $2,000 car would be pretty great.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's a place where, you know, people understand how to make things at low cost.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the high-end offshoring business is still a small sliver
mm-hmm.
of what India exports.
Okay.
So there's real room for growth in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes at a time when U.S. companies are still, you know, striving to cut costs. So I think that could be the next leg.
Yeah, the one certainty in business, right, cost cutting.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, and I mean, this is, you know, a story about, you know, insider trading and fraud as well as India. I mean, so I kind of need to ask, you know, are those bad?
Insider trading and fraud?
Yeah.
Look, I was speaking at the Greenwich Library over the weekend, and someone raised the very legitimate question of, you know, why is insider trading a crime? Because there are no victims. There are no, discernible victims. I think insider trading is important because one of the reasons the U.S. market is so respected the world over
mm-hmm.
is because there's a sense that ordinary investors get a fair shake. They have access to the same information that the big boys do. And you really don't see any capital market that's as liquid and as deep as the American market. And I think in large part it is because it's a transparent market.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, even though there is some work to be done here, but
right.
you know, I guess there's a sense that I mean, do you have the sense that there's a pervasive level of insider trading, or that there's still, you know, a bunch of Rajaratnams out there, you know, calling up people at Intel, having them fax documents, you know?
I think it goes in waves, Will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the last big insider trading case that we had before this one was, of course, memorialized in the book, Den of Thieves,
mm-hmm.
and involved a number of bankers at some of the most prominent Wall Street firms, such as Goldman Sachs and Kidder Peabody. And that was all the way back in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, memories, you know, are not not long. And, you know, certainly after Regulation FD, at the turn of the millennium, which really created a level playing field between big institutions and small investors in terms of the information they received from companies.
Yeah.
After that was put in place, I do think that short-term, event-driven funds, momentum funds, found it a lot harder to make money
mm-hmm.
and started resorting to insider trading as a way to to get an edge.
Yeah, because these guys are obviously trading on,
right,
you know, stuff, you know, minute to minute, different position, not what you would call long-term investors necessarily.
That's right.
You know,
that's
so,
right.
Yeah.
That's,
I mean,
right.
And, you know, one of the, it's tough to have an edge on one thing.
Right.
You know, having an edge on 60 stocks a year or 100 stocks,
right,
a year, very, very tough.
Right. It's tough to have an edge in efficient markets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, on anything. I mean, especially,
yeah,
if you're not a very smart man, as certain of us interviewing you are. another thing I found curious is you interviewed Jeff Skilling a lot. I mean, he may not jump off the page to other people, but was the president of Enron, I think, or CEO? Yeah.
The CEO
of Enron.
That's right.
What is it like to reach out to somebody who has been, you know, basically in prison for fraud for what must be a decade at this point?
Almost a decade. One of the reasons I reached out to Jeff Skilling is that I was looking for people to tell me why Rajat Gupta got elected to the helm of McKinsey, not just once, but three times. And,
mm-hmm,
of course, by the time the charges surrounding Gupta were brought, no one at McKinsey, no one who even knew him, wanted to speak on the record.
Yeah.
There was nothing good to say about Rajat Gupta.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know no one is black and white.
Yeah.
And so I thought, who might talk to me? And I I thought, well, maybe Jeff Skilling will. And so I wrote him a letter, and you have to get on the prison email system. I don't know if you know this, but,
mm-hmm,
it's called Corelinks. And he reached out to me on Corelinks, and he was a typical consultant. He sort of gave me a step-by-step how-to on navigating Corelinks,
mm-hmm,
in case I guess started, you know, a great email relationship with a number of prisoners. Actually, I have a couple right now. And, you know, I found him incredibly eloquent. He would write these long emails, and they were clear and articulate. And every once in a while, sort of the reality of his new life, being in prison, would intrude on our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
One time I remember he was trying to explain something to me about the structure at McKinsey, and you're only allowed an hour on the internet or on the email system when you're in prison. And his hour was up, and so he had to sort of stop the email midway, and it really was midway, and come back to it several hours later.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there was another time I remember I wanted to share something with him, and I sent him a link to a story, and he said, I can't read it because we don't have access to the internet. So, you know, it was really, but he was very, you know, he had a lot of time, and he would write these very detailed emails of Rajat and how McKinsey was structured and some of its values, and he was really, I thought, perfect for the history of the firm as well.
I often wonder if these you know, former high-powered executives who wind up in prison, you know, find themselves doing things like, you know, organizing people into cross-functional teams or, you know, doing any of these things that you might expect. I mean, is there any sense of, you know, what the day-to-day life, what his day-to-day life is like?
Yeah, he used to teach Spanish in the library. He first, I believe, started working in the library, and then he organized classes for the other prisoners in Spanish. And he spent a lot of time, I know, working at that time on his appeal. And I think one of the reasons he reached out and decided to speak to me is because he saw the Gupta case, not the Kumar case, and he was very clear about this. He saw the Gupta case as a sign of the Justice Department overreaching.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, so overreaching.
So, and he drew a distinction because with Anil Kumar, just to recollect the facts for a minute,
mm-hmm,
Anil Kumar, of course, was paid by Rajaratnam,
yeah,
to give insider tips about companies like AMD, and Jeff Skilling thought this was abominable,
mm-hmm,
but Rajat Gupta, where the, you know, the government's case was based on circumstantial evidence, Rajat Gupta was someone that Skilling felt was railroaded by the government, and that's why he decided to speak to me.
Really? Really? That's a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
I guess he must be feeling the same about himself to some extent.
Oh, of course, that goes without saying. That goes without saying. He was very careful about not talking about his own legal case, but it goes without saying that he certainly does not feel that justice has done him proud.
We actually got a copy of the original Enron Code of Ethics that we blogged about on Inside Investing a couple days ago, which was really quite a fascinating read. You know, no corporate employee shall trade the stock, but of course there are stock tickers in the elevator.
Right.
Jeff Skilling, Rajat Gupta, you know, something in the water at McKinsey? What's going on? Is that a thing or is that not a thing?
Well, I think McKinsey, for most of its history, had been built on this honor-driven values culture, which, of course, was espoused by its longtime managing director, Marvin Bauer. And honor-driven, values-driven might have worked when you were a small partnership and everyone sitting in a room could look everyone else in the eye and know what they were about. But today, McKinsey's a global firm. And I think one of the problems the firm encountered is that it had grown so much in the 1990s, but its policies, its procedures, had not kept up with the phenomenal growth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it just sort of had growth pains, and then sort of, oh no.
Right, right.
Sort of in the aftermath of this whole thing, I mean, it's no longer a headline every day. A lot of times when people ask you about this book, they go, for heaven's sake, couldn't you find a good story?
That's right. You know, when I started writing this book a couple years ago, I went to Black Tie Gala in London, and I met a prominent executive of a Wall Street firm, and he said, Anita, of all the books you could write, couldn't you write a positive book about the diaspora?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it is of some frustration to the Indian community that this book captures an unfortunate episode in what has been a remarkable rise of Indians in the United States. But I think it's an important story because one of the reasons Indians are so respected and held in high esteem in this country is because we are known to be hardworking and diligent and generally deliver, you know, on what we promise. And I think blemishes on the diaspora like this risk threatening our reputation, and that's why it was important for me to write the book.
Yeah, and you know, and also probably, you know, as you said at the very beginning, or as we were talking about in the very beginning, you know, this notion that, you know, there are actually, you know, not everyone is perfect and the hardest working person ever and whatever probably helps the community more than hurts it in the long term.
I think so, because I think it shows that you know, we have matured and we're at a point where we even have our own crime. So that must mean we've finally arrived. I mean, people actually, you know, think it's worth their while to prosecute the Indian community for crimes, whereas when I was growing up in the 1970s, we were too small a community to matter.
And of course, the people doing the prosecution, also Indian American,
says
about as much as could be said.
That's right. The official at the SEC who built up the Galleon case, Sanjay Wadhwa, and of course the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District, Preet Bharara, both Indian Americans, and are a sign of how variegated the role of Indians in American society is today.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. For more, visit insideinvesting.org. Thanks so much.